Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. This is a historic week for St. Louis University. Dr. Fred Postello has assumed his duties as university president. He is the first non-priest to head the institution in its almost 200-year history. And he's the first permanent president in 26 years who is not Father Lawrence Biondi. He resigned 10 months ago. Dr. Postello assumes his position following many months of well-publicized turmoil at the university, centering on Father Biondi's management style, faculty distension, and rising student concerns. His appointment is looked upon as a new beginning for SLU, a time of both challenge and opportunity. He comes to St. Louis after spending a quarter century as an academic and administrator at the University of Dayton and the past 6 years as president of Le Moyne College, a Jesuit institution in Syracuse, New York. I'm Don Marsh. Dr. Postello is with us in studio, and also joining in the conversation is St. Louis Public Radio education reporter Dale Singer. Dr. Postello, welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you very much, Don. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you with us, and nice to have you joining us so soon after your arrival, which means you haven't had much time to get your feet on the ground or really get the lay of the land, I guess.
That's right. I'm learning my way around the university as well as around St. Louis.
What was appealing about the job in St. Louis to you?
Yeah, so I started following St. Louis University closely when I moved into senior administration at the University of Dayton. You have a large Catholic population here, some very vibrant and well-known and highly ranked Catholic high schools. And so we were a competitor, and SLU to us was in some ways an aspirant school. So I started following SLU at that point in time and have continued to follow it. I'm passionate about Catholic and Jesuit education. I've spent my entire adult life, except for a brief period after college and in graduate school, in Catholic higher education. I'm Jesuit educated. And when this position became available and I was contacted by the consultant, I became excited about the possibility of leading St. Louis University, which I'd followed so closely for so many years.
I assume you followed some of the issues that preceded your arrival here.
I'm aware of them, yes.
Uh-huh. And what are your thoughts about the – we use the word turmoil, and I think it's an appropriate word given what went on.
Yeah. So what attracted me to St. Louis University is its strength. It's one of seven Jesuit research universities, one of only four Jesuit universities with a medical school. It's got a $1 billion endowment. On most measures, it would be one, two, or three in Jesuit education. So, you know, the power, the strength, the fact that it's international and urban were attractive. I'm aware of the fact that at least at the end of his presidency, there was some controversy around Father Biondi's management style. I think he's given a lot of credit for building the institution and his commitment to St. Louis. I knew there was some concern about how he managed the institution at the very end of the presidency.
Mm-hmm. And there are other issues as well with regard to the law school. There is some student dissent. Have you had a chance to, in your just couple of days on the job, to assess the mood of the campus?
What I found to a person is a very warm and generous, enthusiastic welcome. People have told me how pleased they are that we are here, and I think there's a genuine excitement about the university and its future. People at SLU are committed to the mission, feel good about each other. I think there's a strong sense of community. So it's all been positive.
Good. Have you had an opportunity to talk to Father Biondi?
I have had an opportunity to talk to Father Biondi, not often, since I was named. At the time that I was named, I had an opportunity to meet with Father Biondi. I have not met with him since. We've spoken by phone, I think, twice. Father Biondi will be one of the people I'm meeting with soon, though, to talk in more depth about the university and its future.
Will you offer him a job?
I definitely will talk to Father Biondi about where he thinks he would like to make a contribution and then assess where Father Biondi can continue to contribute.
Well, we have had many press reports indicating that, in fact, he might very well be back running the museum, for instance.
I think any decisions with respect to Father Biondi's future role on the campus are up to me. I have not agreed to anything with respect to what specifically Father Biondi will be doing at this time.
But not ruling it out, I assume.
Right. I'm not ruling anything out or in.
Do you feel any sense that you come to this job at this time that you will be somehow in his shadow?
I think you can't assume a presidency after someone has led an organization for a quarter century and not in some way be in the shadow of the person that you followed will inevitably be different, and that will be determined by the needs of the institution, my style, the people we have here today. But to follow somebody with that tenure, which is extraordinary in higher education, the average presidency is 7 or 8 years. Clearly, there's a legacy there.
You know, one of the many things have been written about this change and your coming. And one of the things that I've read, and perhaps even Dale wrote it, I'm not sure of that, saying that you are going to be watched, scrutinized very, very closely to see if you assume any of your predecessor's traits. Does it put any particular pressure on you?
I don't believe you can be in a role with this without being watched carefully and scrutinized. I don't know of a college president in the country that's not watched carefully by any number of stakeholders. So I don't think that will be much different here.
No intimidation factor there.
Well, it's always a bit intimidating. you know.
Dale, did you write that line?
I don't know if I wrote that particular line. I know I've written many lines about this, what was going on the campus in the last months of the Father Biondi's administration. I'd be curious to follow up on what you were saying about your style and not only comparing it to Father Biondi's style, but how would you define your own style?
Yeah. I'm a fan of Jim Collins' work, Good to Great, which is pretty well known, I think, in leadership circles. I like it. It's data-based. It's empirical. I believe that you surround yourself with the right people, in his terms. You get the right people on the bus. You come together around a common mission, and then you empower those people to do their jobs. I like having a strong, cohesive team and supporting that team. So as I enter the job, one of my first and highest priorities will be to establish a strategic plan and a set of strategic priorities. That will be done in consultation and collaboration with representatives across the campus, and then to make sure I've got a team that is moving forward to execute that plan.
I know that the phrase I heard a lot when I was writing about what was going on was shared governance, and particularly with the faculty. Will the faculty be playing a key role in the strategic process?
Absolutely. I believe strongly in shared governance.
Communication seems to be a key, and it has been heretofore with regard to between the president's office and the faculty. How can you make that better? What's the dynamic there?
So even more so, I think communication is important, but more important than that to me is collaboration. So, you know, if I were to be making all the decisions and simply saying these are the decisions, that's communication. I don't think that works. Mm. I think you have to invite people into the conversations at the right point. And use the brains of all of those people who are part of the organization to seek input, then develop the plan and move forward. So I think it is communication, but it's also equally critical, not more critical, is collaboration.
Is this a more difficult assignment for you because of what has transpired prior to your arrival than it might otherwise have been at another institution? I think you've had other jobs at other institutions.
Yeah.
I suspect it was a lot easier moving into those jobs than this one.
I honestly don't think so. Yeah. Now I've only been here. This is my third day on the job. But to a person, and I've met with a number of people in groups now, both earlier in the semester when I was named, and now people are enthusiastic, exciting, want to move forward, want to create a plan and a vision. So I don't sense any of that difficulty at all. I haven't to date.
In terms of a challenge, what do you see as your biggest challenge?
I think the challenges, the main challenges facing higher education, private higher education today. I think those SLU is not immune from those challenges, the challenges of affordability, the changing demographics, preparedness to make sure that those who come in have the ability to succeed. Those are the challenges that any institution like SLU would face. So how do we continue to be the first choice for the students, faculty, staff, and stakeholders we want to attract? What must change? How must we adapt? That's the challenge, and I think you start with gathering the community together and the broad community, internal and external, to say basically what must we be and then how do we become that?
It's almost unfair to ask the question because you've only been here for a couple of days, but I know you've interacted with board members. What sense of the community do you get and the community's concerns about what happens next?
Yeah, I think that what I've heard, and again, my exposure has been quite narrow, The people of St. Louis want St. Louis University to continue to be involved and commit to this city and this region. I couldn't agree more. Internally, I think people want to share in participating in deciding a direction and then get on with the business of moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Dale, you looked like you had.
You talked about affordability before, and I know that the big balancing act is affordability and quality. You want to make sure that students can afford to come. You want to make sure you've got the money to pay for top quality faculty. I know some faculty have mentioned to me that there's a bit of an exodus from the professors and others who are leaving the school because they can get a better salary elsewhere. How do you view achieving that balance?
Yeah, so part of it comes from fundraising. There's an initiative now I know at the university, Go Forward, it's called, where $3.7 million was raised this year to help supplement tuition, so to provide additional scholarship dollars. So in the student end, it's how do you keep the price of tuition low? And clearly, then, that's pitted against the cost of higher education. How do you attract good people? How do you have appropriate facilities? How do you provide the sort of education that students want in the classroom and then the amenities and opportunities outside of the classroom, yet keep it affordable? One of the stories I like to tell, when I was at the University of Dayton, I was at a recruitment fair, as we called them, in Rochester, New York, and open up to questions. And, you know, the questions are my son and daughter going to be taught by a full-time faculty member? Is the class size small? Do you have contemporary labs? Are the residence halls air-conditioned? You know, and you get all these questions, and you hear what people want. And then the question comes, why do you keep going up above inflation every year? Well, that's the tension. How do you offer how do you have a high-quality faculty? You know, there's pressure now. Students want to participate in sports, not just varsity sports. They want to participate in club sports. They want opportunities for recreation. All those things cost money. There's an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Every fall, almost every college or university campus, when the students return, the demand for bandwidth goes, you know, off the charts. They want to stream videos. They want to do everything they did at home. That costs money. How do you provide them with all of that, yet keep it affordable on the other side? That's where the tension is. And I think that's where our struggle is. So how do we maintain efficiencies where we can? How do we fundraise where it's possible? How do we make students smart consumers, financial consumers, in terms of their borrowing and taking advantage of opportunities to get financial support? Those are the things we're struggling with.
We were talking with Dr. Fred Pistello, who is the new president, and by new, I mean really new. He just started work this week, a new president of St. Louis University. We're going to continue our conversation. Dale Singer is with me in studio, as is Dr. Pistello. Welcome back. We'll have questions, and we'll like to solicit yours as well. If you'd like to give us a call, do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, and if you'd prefer to send us a tweet, we'll take that as well as STL on air. Back with Dr. Fred Pistello in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Dr. Fred Pistello, who is the new president of St. Louis University. But before we continue that conversation, these are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Mississippi River is reaching flood levels to the north of St. Louis, and some towns in the area will be affected by the rising waters. As Fair St. Louis sets to kick off this evening, the hospitals bordering Forest Park are working with St. Louis police and fire departments to make sure emergency vehicles won't be hindered by the festivities. And Missouri Governor Nixon is signing a bill in Jefferson City today, or Jefferson County, I should say, that will allow first responders to administer antidotes to people who have overdosed on heroin. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on 90.7 KWMU and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Fred Pistello, who is the new president of St. Louis University. Before we go to the phones, and if Dale takes another question for me, let me ask, did you have any particular marching orders from the board as they brought you in and say, this is what we've just been through, and this is where we want to go?
I think that the board was clear that they expect me to work collaboratively to develop a strategic plan. That's the one thing I heard very clearly. I have not yet had a chance to meet with the full board, to get to know the board. I know some individual trustees who served on the search and selection committee, but I've not yet been to a board meeting.
With regard to the strategic plan, and again, it's almost unfair given the fact that you're just here, but do you have any sense of what the real priority is going to be in fashioning it?
In terms of the specifics, no. I would assume that we want to continue to be a premier Jesuit research university, and what do we need to do to focus upon to be that, given the range of programs we offer?
It does not have a Jesuit as its head, and one of the students at the university just graduated asked me to ask, does that mean that the Jesuit influence at the institution is waning?
I would argue not. And if you would talk to the leadership of the order, all the way up to, I think, Father General, the Jesuits have long been committed to collaboration with lay leaders and see now, I think, increasingly with the number of Jesuits that are there, as we've seen the numbers in the order diminish, that those things that priests do not absolutely need to do – offering the sacraments and so forth, lay leadership is going to come in and fill. And they've been incredibly supportive of that. So at the institutions at which I have previously served, I think that people would say that I specifically have, in fact, enhanced the mission of the institution. And I think that's the case for other lay leaders that I've seen at Catholic
universities
and colleges.
It's not unlike what's going on within the church itself.
Yes. And often, in fact, I've been mistaken for being a religious, often called father, and people don't quite even realize that I am not. And I wonder sometimes actually when I'm out with my wife what people think if they're making that assumption.
So. It's all right for your kids to call you father,
yeah,
though, right?
Yeah.
Well, you were the first lay president at Lemoyne.
Yes.
And talk about how that transition was managed and how you think the lessons you learned there might be apply here.
Yeah, so I think what's critical is you move into this position as a lay leader, although a Jesuit would do the same. I made it a point when I was moving into the presidency at Lemoyne to talk to a number of Jesuit presidents and to talk to them about how they went about their roles. I talked with the head of the Association of Jesuit Colleges and Universities. I've stayed close to the provincial and the bishop. So I think those are critical relationships. One's relationship with the provincial, one's relationship with the bishop. So that's the order in the church. And the Jesuit presidents, as you may know, get together twice a year, talk about mission and continuing to strengthen mission. So I've felt that I've had incredible support and guidance. I'm steeped in the tradition. I think I understand the tradition and intend to enhance it at the university.
We have a number of callers who are wanting to talk to you, Dr. Postel. Let's get that process started, and we'll continue with our questionings with Dale Singer. But we'll bring in Tim calling from St. Louis. I understand Tim is an employee of the university. Go ahead, Tim.
Welcome, Dr. Postel.
Thank you.
We appreciate the your presence and all of your skills, and we look forward to the great changes that you'll be responsible for. As an employee, I just ask you to look closely at all the sides, and it is a great community that we have here, but there are a lot of challenges, a lot of frustration, a lot of disappointment. And I think that happens with any great venture and any great challenges. So I just hope that you look at that so that we can continue to do the best work we can there.
Great. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks.
Tim, well, there's an official welcome from one of your employees. Well, let's bring in Bob now calling. While we were talking a moment ago about Jesuit influence, I think Bob wants to get into that part of the conversation. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, I do. The new president of St. Louis University is going on and on about Jesuit this and Jesuit that and Jesuit education. Perhaps he's not aware that several years ago, the board of St. Louis University swore up and down in court that they were not a Jesuit institution, that they were a secular institution, and they did that so they could get government-guaranteed bond money. So if you think that this is, in fact, a Jesuit institution, I'm wondering, sir, will you return any of that money that was fraudulently obtained?
So St. Louis University is a Catholic Jesuit university. We are one of 28 Jesuit universities in the United States. In the late 1960s, Catholic colleges and universities went to lay boards of trustees. They are now the governing boards, but we are in that faith tradition and in the tradition of the charism. very much a part of the Jesuit network.
Well, then, why didn't the Jesuits pay for that money that you took from the general public? Why should we support their educational institution?
We are.
If you don't want to answer, if you don't want to answer that question, I'll give you another.
We're financially independent from the order and the church. Nonetheless, we follow that faith tradition as well as the charism of that order. We are not one financial organization. We are independent financially, governed by a lay board of trustees.
Lay board drops their pants and bends over whenever the
chance. All right. We can deal with the phraseology that's a little more refined than that. Thank you so much for your call. We're moving on. I have an email, a tweet, from Robbie, who says, how will you assist the LGBT community on campus feel more visible and inclusive?
I have not yet had a chance to know the LGBT community on campus, but I'd be interested in meeting with them and understanding how they feel about their position on campus now and how we can work together in the future.
All right. I think that answers that question. You know, one of the things that people have mentioned is the fact that your medical school, the medical institution through the university, is a wonderful part of St. Louis University. But you don't have any experience dealing with medical schools in your past, do you?
I have not had a medical school at the two institutions at which I previously worked.
So how does that work, coming in and having that to deal with such an important part of the institution?
It's clearly an important part of the institution. And just last night, probably as the first formal meeting I've had as president, I met with the chairs of all the clinical divisions, about 15 people, for about an hour to understand what they're excited about, their areas of specialization, their needs and aspirations. It's, as you would imagine, a very impressive group, very committed to delivering high-quality health care and wanting to serve the region.
What were their concerns?
How can we continue to provide them with the equipment and opportunities and needs so that they can practice state-of-the-art medicine? To a person, they talked about what a collaborative group they are, what a supportive group they are, how wonderful our medical students are, and how thrilled they are with the school. But moving forward, healthcare is in flux. We still don't know what the full implications of the Affordable Care Act are going to be. And so how do we remain nimble and continue to serve? I think we serve about 500,000 people a year through that practice. How do we continue to have what they need to deliver the care, that high-quality care they want to, in an environment that is very much changing?
Does this put you in any kind of unusual, that's not the right word, I can't find the one I'm looking for, but in terms of a learning curve and learning how to manage an operation that includes a facility like this?
Yeah. So I've had professional schools before, law schools, other professional schools. Medicine is different in the sense of the tradition and the practice, but I have no doubt that we'll be able to work together very effectively and collaboratively.
We have another phone call, this one from Catherine calling from St. Louis. Catherine, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Well, I'd like to welcome the new president and to St. Louis and to St. Louis University. I am an alum myself. My dad taught biology for many years, Nelson Wade, and my mother achieved her PhD. Well, actually, she did a lot of schooling at St. Louis U. But I'm wondering, one, how Father Reinert is remembered, what his legacy continues to be. And I'm curious what kind of collaboration can be done amongst the three major universities. It seems like they all might be able to save some resources if they weren't each like their own little juggernauts.
Yeah. Good. Well, thank you, Catherine. I'm getting to know the past presidencies, the past presidents, and their legacies. The one thing that I think Father Reinert is most celebrated about is his commitment to keeping St. Louis University in St. Louis and to working to develop the region around the immediate campus in particular. With respect to collaboration, again, I'm brand new. I can't imagine that there isn't some degree of collaboration and even more opportunity for that. In the previous positions I've held, we very much worked with the other institutions in the region to develop collaborative programs. I'm keenly interested in doing that here in St. Louis, and I imagine that my counterparts are equally interested in doing that. I hope to be able to meet them soon and begin to talk about where that collaboration makes sense. That would also help, obviously, with the affordability issue as well as the quality issue.
I should mention for those in the audience who might be a little bit younger that Father Reinert was Larry Biondi's predecessor in that office, and that's going back a quarter of a century and more.
Well, yeah, a couple. There were a few presidents in between too,
yep,
but
sure.
they both had similarly long tenures at the head of the university. I wanted to ask, you know, as long as we're talking history, we have a university has a 200th anniversary coming up. Some people were complaining during the waning months of the Biondi administration that really didn't seem to be much planning in terms of a capital campaign and other things that were going on. Is that going to be stepped up now?
Yeah, absolutely, Dale. I think that prior to my arrival, the institution was thinking about the fact that we will be 200 years old, which is obviously something to celebrate, and planning a campaign with that. That's something I'll be very much interested in and interested in accelerating. I have little doubt that that is one thing that will happen. We will, at some point within the next couple of years, announce a campaign around the 200th anniversary of St. Louis University.
I'd like to ask you, Dr. Pistello, about your vision and feelings about the role of the university here in this part of the community, the Grand Center. I think it's well known the work that Father Biondi did with regard to improvements at the university and its role here. What kind of thought have you given to that?
Yeah, so one of the things that struck me and I think strikes most visitors to the campus is how beautiful it is, particularly for an urban campus. Father Biondi clearly had a strong aesthetic sense, and you can see that reflected in the beauty of SLU. Vince Schemel came out to Syracuse and met with me to talk about Grand Center and its importance. I've not had an opportunity to be in many of those buildings, but I've driven around the neighborhood. It's quite impressive. I believe that our borders are absolutely critical to the institution. I'm very supportive of the development of the arts. I intend to be active in the development of the region, especially in the city, particularly in Midtown. To a person, those who have brought up this topic have been very strong that they want to see St. Louis University continue to be a good citizen and partner in the region, and I intend to be.
Do you think that the university could even expand its role? I know there's a lot of opportunity to the north of Grand Center or some opportunity to the south of the Medical Center. Do you see it expanding, or do you think Grand Center is about all you can handle with everything else going on?
I think it's a little early for me to answer that with any authority, Dale, because I'm just not sure what we're doing, what we're not doing, and where the opportunities are. But I'm absolutely interested in exploring that.
You know, again, a lot has been written about you prior to your coming here, and a lot of it has been very, very complimentary. I have some notes here. You're very approachable, easygoing, even-tempered, an effective leader, hard worker, and sensitive to faculty concerns. All positives. There are also some negatives. Likes bureaucracy, tone deaf when it comes to spending money, spent large amounts of money on lavish office space and previous appointments. Well, welcome to St. Louis.
Yeah. When I got to Lemoyne College, it was clear that Lemoyne had not invested in facilities at all. There hadn't been a building built in 15 years. Deferred maintenance was atrocious. I was very fortunate. We were incredibly successful with fundraising. Within 6 months, we received a $50 million gift, and it was a real $50 million, and that was the fall of 08 when everything was falling apart. So it was, I see it as a gift from God to come at that time. So we were able to engage in the largest building campaign the campus had ever seen. New science building, renovation of the old science building. We built a pub, completely renovated the cafeteria, new classrooms. Most of the investment went in academic buildings. When I started, we were stalled in a $30 million campaign. The board at my first meeting was thinking about closing the campaign. I helped convince them to continue with it. That $50 million campaign ended up at $91 million. Mm-hmm. Within 2 years, I started another campaign around a lead gift for the naming of the School of Business. We raised so much cash that in phase one of construction, we not only reskinned the building, we did the entire first floor. We were only supposed to do half of it. When we decided, and we had a quick timeline, again, because we raised the money so quickly, I had to move my office. So the dean of business went into the space where I was. My office was moved into the main administration building. We did my office on the level we were doing all new construction. It is much nicer than the office it was in. And it went back to the main administration building where I thought it belonged. Were some faculty and students upset about that? Yes. I think particularly those faculty in areas that had not yet been renovated. I didn't hear anything from faculty who were in areas that had been renovated. I think the next phase is to continue that renovation. Some faculty at Lemoyne are in offices which are absolutely not attractive, too small, have water leaks, and so forth.
All right. Dale?
So what's your secret to raising so much money?
You know, it's realizing, quite honestly, that it's a long-term thing. That $50 million gift was decades in cultivation. Knowing how to work with donors to show them the power of what can be done at the institution, working with the right people around the right ideas, bringing in faculty and students, it's being out there, being aggressive, knowing how to tell the story, and working with someone with capacity and interest to help them realize their dreams of funding something significant.
How much a part of your job here is that going to be? And being a newcomer, I assume it's going to take some time to get to know where the money is.
Yeah, and so that's always a balance. I think initially there's a lot of feeling I've got internally to the campus that people want me there and visible and present. They want to talk to me. They want me to know what the issues, challenges, opportunities, concerns are. And that will, it's always tensions, and that's what somebody has to work through. On the other hand, there's going to be a lot of pressure to get out and meet with people, get to know the stakeholders, especially as we go into this campaign. So I think initially, especially the first 6 months or so, I tend to spend a lot of time on campus getting to know people and the campus, and then increasingly devote a higher proportion of my time to being off campus cultivating gifts.
Politicians will tell you the thing they hate most about running for office is having to go out with hat in hand and raise money. Is that going to be tough for you, do you think?
Yeah, I don't view it like that. It's not hat in hand. I'm not asking for money for me. I'm asking for people to invest in the mission of the institution.
Dr. Fred Pistello, who is the new president of St. Louis University, we're going to continue our conversation. And again, I encouraged you, the listener, to get into it. Give us a call at 382-TALK, or send us an email at talk@stopublicradio.org. Back with Dale Singer and Dr. Fred Pistello in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back. We continue our conversation with Dr. Fred Pistello, the new president, newly arrived president at St. Louis University. Dr. Pistello, another question that was given to me by a former student at St. Louis University before he went on the air, a concern that the humanities in course instruction at the university are getting short shrift, that the funding that's available is going elsewhere, and that is not being addressed in the humanities area. Have you had a chance to think about that, look into that, or hear about it?
No. So I'm not well-versed in those concerns. I can tell you, at any Jesuit university, you're going to see that I think the education at the undergraduate level starts in the humanities. You'll typically find larger religious studies, theology, philosophy departments because of the core curriculum. So I think it's absolutely essential. The liberal arts, I'm passionate about the liberal arts and liberal arts education. So that's something I'm interested in learning more about, and if we need to make investments there, how can we make those investments?
How much control do you have over that sort of thing as president of the university?
I would like to think some degree of significant control.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's always amazing, and I remember when I first became department chair at Dayton, I had, to use round numbers, I don't know what it was. I had budget. I'm handed the department budget $1 million. And then after I go through it and look at, the salary lines and telephones, I realized I had about $30,000 out of that million that I could actually use to influence things. So, yeah, you're constrained. Most of your money is tied up. It takes a little bit of time to turn things. But I do think that it's my role to be an advocate for the liberal arts as the core of the Jesuit education at St. Louis University on the undergraduate side.
You know, talking about humanities and liberal arts brings back to the larger question, but people often ask, both students and their parents, the value of a college education. Particularly, yeah. I'm an English major. I've been able to find work over the last few decades, but I know that a lot of people are concerned. Should their child be an English major, or should they major in something that are more likely to find a good job in?
Yeah.
What's your answer to that?
So I'm glad you asked that, and let me start by just briefly talking about affordability and then working into the liberal arts. One of the things I like to say whenever I have the opportunity, as I do now, and let me thank you both again for allowing me this opportunity on KWMU. When you look at anyone considering private higher education, I hope that they are not deterred by the sticker price. If you look at the data, and I encourage people to go to the NAICU site, NAICU, National Association of Independent Colleges and Universities, which shows from 2008-09 until I think it's 12-13, in that five-year period, the net tuition, average net tuition of private colleges and universities, I think went down 8%. So a private higher education in net inflation-controlled dollars actually has decreased. So what's happened? I think that we've responded to that crisis of 2008 by increasing what we call financial aid, both funded and unfunded, what we call the discount rate. So I would hope that people, and there's research to show particularly people of lower socioeconomic strata, tend to be deterred by the sticker price. If you're considering private higher education or higher education in general, apply and talk to the financial aid office and see if it's affordable. That said, people struggle with, well, is the investment? And we know that the investment's worth it. College education from the financial side. Yes, the average loan, I think, is about $30,000 now. So average students coming out with some degree of debt. But if you look at lifetime earnings, it's staggering how much more a college graduate will earn. Lower rates of unemployment among college graduates. There's no doubt that investment in a college education pays off on average for people. Then there's the question, well, yes, on average, depending on the area in which you obtain your degree, there are differences in lifetime earning. There are certainly exceptions. I'm a sociology major. You're an English major. I encourage students to pursue their passion. I have dealt with cases over the course of my life, some very sad. I had an engineer in my office who was an advisee of mine. I remember crying. This young man was crying because he did not want to be an engineering major, and his parents were telling him that was the only way they were going to pay for his education. Is that a good story? He wanted to major in sociology, what could I do other than listen to him and try to be somewhat sympathetic? It's clear the world is becoming increasingly complex, and those who are good critical thinkers, have well-developed and refined basic skills, are, to my mind, the ones who are going to continue to be successful. Can you write? Can you speak? Do you have some sense of science and the scientific method? Do you have some sort of quantitative reasoning? Those basic skills coming out of the liberal arts are fundamental for career success, career flexibility, also for leading a richer life. So I think I hope that parents would not try to sway or discourage their sons and daughters from pursuing degrees in the humanities, social sciences, if that's where their passions are.
But, we're looking at student debt, and the figures are well known. There's a greater amount of student debt in the country today than credit card debt. I mean, parents are having their own economic difficulties, and it's really hard to imagine they can be enthusiastic about what you've just said when they're staring at perhaps $100,000 in debt for their kids.
Yeah. So, there are some of those sensational stories, $100,000 in debt. I think the research shows that's a very small percentage of people, and those people typically have gone to school well beyond the general four-year period and switch majors a number of times. That's
often just, because they can't get jobs when they finish their four years.
I do think we need to do a good job and perhaps a better job of educating students and their parents about borrowing and what borrowing should be for, which should be for the education, not for buying things in addition to the education, cars, et cetera, as there's some evidence to show that some do, with the money that becomes available to them. Nonetheless, I think that the data is clear, it is a wise and good investment in terms of average lifetime earnings and lower rates of unemployment.
Yeah. I've asked this question of college presidents over the years, and I've never really heard what I consider to be a good answer. People always say, well, we charge the sticker price, so we can bring in enough money so we can turn around and give financial aid to people who can't afford the sticker price. And the question that always occurs to me is, why not just have a lower price to start with?
Yeah. So thank you for giving me the opportunity perhaps to be the first college president who can satisfactorily answer that question for you. let me try. What financial aid allows us to do is to try to make it more affordable for students of lesser means. So let's say that, use Rao's numbers, the average, let's say the sticker price is $30,000 and the average amount of discounting is 50%, so the average student is paying $15,000. That's the average student. Some students are paying nothing. Some are paying $5,000, some are paying $10,000. If you lower it down to $15,000, those paying $15,000 to $30,000 are absolutely going to be able to afford to come. Student who's paying nothing or $5,000 or $10,000 is now out. So what it does is it allows us to have a socioeconomic mix and allow students coming from families of lesser means to attend. That's what it does. And I think that fits with our mission as a Jesuit institution. I'm committed to it.
We have another question via email, and you probably haven't been here long enough to be able to deal with this, but the question is, what are the plans, the university's plans for the Peavely property? Are you familiar with that?
Only on the Vegas level. I know that it was a dairy. I think most of the land is cleared. There is still a building there, and I think it's by our medical complex.
I'll give you the information, and then you can respond as best you can. Again, keeping in mind July 1st was your first day on the job. SLU received approval from the city in 2012 to demolish several buildings at the Peavely Dairy site. The university wanted to use the property to build medical offices and threatened to look in the county if they didn't get the permissions they needed. The university went through with the demolition of three buildings, but as far as we know, hasn't moved toward getting a permit to build anything there. What can you tell us about that?
Nothing. Other than, clearly, I mean, it's come up. I've heard about it. I know it's an issue. I'll know more next time we get together here.
Sure. Well, you know, I give you a lot of credit for coming to a radio program where you're getting questions from us and from people that you've never met in view of a lot of the things that have gone on there. And taking this on after just a couple of days. And thank you for that. We have an email here from Loretta asking, WashU has supported public transit by providing free access to Metro Transit for their employees. What role could SLU play in supporting regional efforts to improve public transit in the region?
So I don't know what role we can play. I don't know what role we do play. I do know that that's something that's important, and I promise to look into it.
All righty. Well, thank you for that answer. We have another question here. I'm wondering about the role of athletics at the university. Opinion on student athletes having the right to organize. There's a good one for you. Question being asked all over the country, by the way.
Yes. I think it's a particular concern at the high-level Division I schools where, as I understand it, and I'm not yet well-versed on this issue, student athletes have had their images used for profit, and they've not been able to share in that. I don't have a perspective on that at this time. I just don't know enough about it. I have been at Lemoyne at a Division II school where this has not been an issue. I'm very much aware that SLU, like Dayton, is a Division I school, and I'm thrilled with that. I'm thrilled with the success of the team and the quality of the athletics. I don't yet know enough about that to offer an informed opinion.
Let me ask about this because I know that's an issue that all colleges are facing, and that's online courses. What would you like to see in terms of what SLU would be doing as far as expanding online, and what form would you like it to take?
So I know that at the graduate level, adult learner in nursing, we are doing some online programming. I still see the core of what we do at the undergraduate level as being largely face-to-face, supplemented with technology and technological supplements to it. I taught a class last fall with I co-taught it with a young philosopher just out of graduate school, and I felt like a dinosaur. You know, I know how to lecture. I know how to get discussion. But he was able to do all kind of whiz-bang things, pulling a YouTube video and going to this site. So technology is enhancing what we're doing even in the classroom. In terms of distance education or hybrid, I still think the core of what we do with the traditional 18 to 22-year-old student is going to have a large face-to-face component. I think it's part of our tradition and important, not that it's not supplemented with technology. That said, for the adult learner and many master's programs. I think increasingly we're moving toward hybrid courses and distance learning. I don't know enough about what's being done here at St. Louis University, but can't imagine that in some areas we're not moving or already leading in that area.
I know for those of us in journalism, it was just a profound shift in the entire profession. Do you think it's going to be that much of a profound shift over the next 10 or 15 years in higher education?
I think we're going to continue to struggle with its appropriate use. Will it supplant completely bricks and mortars in institutions? I don't believe so.
A lot of people think it's going to have to go in that direction. Now, we've already talked about the high cost of education, but that this is one way to bring those costs down and make it more accessible to more people.
In many ways, technology is added to our costs. If you look at what's happened in terms of, you know, when I started, one of the things that I was struck by, when I started at the University of Dayton, there were no personal computers. You punched IBM cards and you fed them into a card sorter. I remember as provost once, we lost electricity in the middle of the day, and I was getting calls, should we shut the university down and go home? Because nobody could access their computer. I mean, that's how the world's changed in my lifetime. So clearly, we're highly dependent on technology. We've had to make incredible investments in having these things on the desk and the pipes and so forth, providing the bandwidth. It's added cost in many ways. Can it ultimately be used to reduce cost? Yes. I mean, people can learn electronically and in distance learning. Will it replace the traditional education for the 18 to 22-year-old full-time student? I don't think so. It will supplement it. I don't think that those young people are ready to be entirely free of a campus and a direct mentoring relationship with a faculty and staff that they can learn at the same level and depth as they do, not to mention the ties to people. I still, one of my faculty members at John Carroll University, and I graduated in 1974, just retired this year. Now, he was young when I was there. He's followed my career. He's supported me over the course of my career. Those sorts of things have been important to my development and I think are important to the students we serve at institutions like SLU.
You know, we talked a moment ago about the university's role and its position here in Grand Center. Not too far removed from what might be generously called a disadvantaged area in St. Louis. Do you see a role for the university in dealing with the problems that are so pronounced in areas like that?
Yeah, those problems are obviously complex and not easily solved. If they were, we wouldn't see the amount of poverty we see both in urban and rural areas across the country. I think it's key for us, given our mission, and as a good citizen here in the region, to participate in trying to alleviate and solve some of those problems. Am I naive that we could come in, that I could come in, that anybody can come in and do something quickly that would have a dramatic impact? If there were such a solution, we would have seen it implemented a long time ago.
But one of the reasons for the problems in these neighborhoods is the fact that young people don't have the opportunity to go to college.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that it's incumbent upon us to begin by working with the elementary schools and secondary schools to make sure that those students are retained and prepared and then provide them the opportunity. I've been involved in a number of initiatives in Dayton and in Syracuse. I was on a group in Syracuse called 2020. I co-chaired the Education Task Force where we were actually starting with a literacy program from the Dolly Parton Foundation where at birth in the hospital an infant is registered. And the Dolly Parton Foundation will send a book to that child's home every month until they're 5 years old. We had to, in Syracuse, provide the postage. They provided the books. But there's evidence to show that parents reading to children makes a dramatic difference in terms of how they start elementary school. So I think we have to start right at the beginning with how do we make sure that those children are prepared for school, they're developing the skills necessary to succeed, to be retained. Many urban school districts have a 50% or less high school graduation rate. That's where we start, and then we continue up through colleges and universities.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking with Dr. Fred Pistello, who is the new president of St. Louis University. We have a call here that we can't take from Alex, who says, by the way, the Veterans Outreach Program at St. Louis University is great.
Thank you, Alex.
And by the way, you mentioned, I think with some fondness in your voice, that you have spent a lot of time teaching. Plan to do any of that here?
Probably not the first year or two, but ultimately I would like to do that again, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Pistello. Dale, for being with us. Dale Singer, thank you for being a part of the program today. I'll remind listeners that tomorrow at this time, Cityscape will be preempted for the Capitol Steps 4th of July special. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Kevin Colleen about his new book, which takes a humorous look at Webster Unit Grove's family vacation in Michigan. Then we'll take a look at the St. Louis connection with Nigeria and the turmoil there. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Kyle Jacoby, Amanda Huntingford, and Spencer Reed. Executive producers, Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.